up, crying, "Mirror of mine that I so admire, show me how to grant my daughter's heart's desire." The mirror was silent for a moment, but within its glassy center, an image began to form. A tiny cottage in the middle of a deep, dark wood, smoke pluming from a little stone chimney. Inside the window sat a young maiden, spinning at a wheel and singing with the birds on the sill. "What is this you show me?" gasped the queen. "Is this young woman a healer?" The mirror's voice was low and somber. "In the dark woods on the kingdom's edge lies a cottage. Inside is a golden egg with the power to grant its holder their heart's desire. The maiden you see is the guardian of the golden egg." "How will I get the egg from her?" said the queen. "She does what she does for the kingdom's good," said the mirror, "and will not easily consent." "Then what must I do?" But the magic looking glass had no more answers, and the image of the cottage faded, so that only glass remained. The queen lifted her chin and stared down her long nose, holding her own gaze, until a slight smile formed on her lips. Early the next morning, the queen summoned the princess's closest handmaiden, a girl who had lived in the kingdom all her life, and who the queen knew could be counted on to perform whatever task was necessary in order to ensure the princess's health and happiness. The queen instructed the handmaiden to retrieve the golden egg. The handmaiden set off across the kingdom in the direction of the dark woods. For 3 days and nights she walked east, and as dusk was falling on the third night, she came to the edge of the woods. She stepped over fallen branches and cleared a path through foliage, until finally, standing in a clearing before her, was a tiny cottage with sweetly scented smoke pluming from its chimney. The handmaiden knocked on the door and waited. When it opened, a young maiden stood on the other side, and although she was surprised to see a visitor on her doorstep, a generous smile spread across her face. She stepped aside and welcomed the handmaiden across the threshold. "You are tired," said the maiden. "You have journeyed far. Come and warm yourself by my hearth." The handmaiden followed the maiden inside and sat on a cushion by the fire. The maiden of the cottage brought a bowl of warm broth and sat quietly weaving while her guest ate. The fire crackled on the grate, and the warmth in the room made the handmaiden very drowsy. Her desire to slumber was so strong that she would have forgotten her mission had the maiden of the cottage not said, "You are very welcome here, stranger, but must forgive me for asking whether there is a purpose to your visit." "I have been sent by the queen of the land," said the handmaiden. "She seeks your assistance in healing her daughter's ill health." The birds of the forest sometimes sang of goings-on within the kingdom. Thus had the maiden heard tell of the fair and kind princess who lived inside the castle walls. "I will do what I can," said the maiden, "though I cannot think why the queen has sent for me, as I know not how to heal." "The queen has sent me to seek something that you harbor," said the handmaiden, "an object with the power to grant its bearer her heart's desire." The maiden understood then that it was the golden egg of which the handmaiden spoke. She shook her head sadly. "I would do anything to help the princess, except that which you ask. Protecting the golden egg is my birthright, and there is naught more important than that. You may stay here tonight and shelter from the cold and lonely woods, but tomorrow you must return to the kingdom and tell the queen that I cannot relinquish the golden egg." Next day, the handmaiden set off for the castle. She journeyed for 3 days and nights until finally she arrived at the castle walls where the queen was waiting for her. "Where is the golden egg?" said the queen, looking at the handmaiden's empty hands. "I have failed in my mission," said the handmaiden, "for alas, the maiden of the cottage would not be parted from her birthright." The queen drew herself to her full height, and her face turned red. "You must return," she said, pointing a long taloned finger at the handmaiden, "and tell the maiden it is her duty to serve her kingdom. If she fails, she will be turned to stone and left to stand in the kingdom courtyard for all eternity." So the handmaiden headed east once more, journeyed for 3 days and nights until she found herself again at the door to the hidden cottage. She knocked and was greeted happily by the maiden, who welcomed her inside and fetched her a bowl of broth. The maiden sat weaving while the handmaiden ate her supper, until finally she said, "You are very welcome here, stranger, but must forgive me for asking whether there is a purpose to your visit." "I have been sent once more by the queen of the land," said the handmaiden. "She seeks your assistance in healing her daughter's ill health. Your duty is to serve your kingdom. If you refuse, the queen says you will be turned to stone and made to stand in the kingdom courtyard for all eternity." The maiden smiled sadly. "Protecting the golden egg is my birthright," she said. "I cannot relinquish it to you."
"Do you wish to be turned to stone?"
"I do not," said the maiden, "and neither shall I be, for I serve my kingdom when I watch over the golden egg." And the handmaiden did not argue, for she saw that what the maiden of the cottage said was true. Next day, the handmaiden set off for the castle, and when she arrived, the queen was once again waiting for her at the castle walls. "Where is the golden egg?" said the queen, looking at the handmaiden's empty hands. "Again have I failed in my mission," said the handmaiden, "for alas, the maiden of the cottage would not be parted from her birthright."
"Did you not tell the maiden that it was her duty to serve the kingdom?"
"I did, your majesty," said the handmaiden, "and she said that by guarding the golden egg, she was serving the kingdom."
The queen glowered, and her face turned grey. Clouds gathered in the sky, and the ravens of the kingdom flew for cover.
The queen remembered then the mirror's words. "She does what she does for the kingdom's good," and her lips curled into a grin.
"You must return once more," she said to the handmaiden, "and this time you will tell the maiden that if she fails to relinquish the golden egg, she will be responsible for the princess's eternal sorrow, which will cast the kingdom into an endless winter of grief."
So the handmaiden headed east for a third time, journeying for 3 days and nights, until she found herself once more at the door to the hidden cottage. She knocked and was greeted happily by the maiden, who welcomed her inside and fetched her a bowl of broth. The maiden sat weaving while the handmaiden ate her supper, until finally she said, "You are very welcome here, stranger, but must forgive me for asking whether there is a purpose to your visit." "I have been sent once more by the queen of the land," said the handmaiden. "She seeks your assistance in healing her daughter's ill health. Your duty is to serve your kingdom. If you fail to relinquish the egg, the queen says you will be responsible for the princess's eternal sorrow, and the kingdom will be cast into an endless winter of grief." The maiden of the cottage sat still and silent for a long time. Then she nodded slowly. "To spare the princess and to spare the kingdom, I will relinquish the golden egg." The handmaiden shivered as the dark woods grew quiet, and an ill wind slipped beneath the door to worry the hearth fire.
But there is nothing more important than protecting your birthright, she said. It is your duty to the kingdom. The maiden smiled, but what use is such a duty if my actions sink the kingdom into an endless winter? An endless winter will freeze the land. There will be no birds or animals or crops. It is because of my duty that I now relinquish the golden egg. The handmaiden looked sadly at the maiden. But there is naught more important than protecting your birthright. The egg is a part of you, yours to protect. But the maiden had already taken a large golden key from around her neck and was fitting it in the lock of the special door. As she turned it, there was a groan from deep within the floor of the cottage, a settling of the hearthstones, a sigh from the ceiling rafters. Light faded in the cottage as a glow appeared from inside the secret room. The maiden disappeared, then appeared once more, holding in her hands a shrouded object, so precious that the air around it seemed to hum. The maiden walked the handmaiden out of the cottage, and when the two reached the edge of the clearing, she handed over her birthright. When she turned back towards her cottage, she saw that it was darker. Light had disappeared, unable suddenly to penetrate the thick surrounding woods. Inside, the rooms grew cold, no longer warmed from within by the glow of the golden egg. Over time, the animals stopped coming, and the birds flew away, and the maiden found that she had no purpose. She forgot how to spin. Her voice faded to a whisper, and finally she felt her limbs grow stiff and heavy, immobile. Until one day she realized that a layer of dust had coated the cottage and her own frozen form. She allowed her eyes to close and felt herself falling through the cold and the silence. Some seasons later, the princess of the kingdom was riding with her handmaiden on the edge of the dark woods. Though once she had been very ill, the princess had recovered miraculously and was now married to a fine prince. She lived a full and happy life, walked and danced and sang, and enjoyed all the vast riches of health. They had a dear baby girl who was much loved and ate pure honey and drank the dew from rose petals, and had beautiful butterflies for playthings. As the princess and her handmaiden rode by the dark woods on this day, the princess felt an odd compulsion to enter the woods themselves. She ignored the handmaiden's protestations and steered her horse across the border and into the cold, dark forest. All was silent in the woods. Neither bird, nor beast, nor breeze stirred the still, cool air. The horse's hooves made the only sound. By and by they came across a clearing in which a tiny cottage had been devoured by foliage.
"Why, what a dear little house," said the princess. "I wonder who lives here."
The handmaiden turned her face away, shivering against the strange chill of the clearing. "No one, my princess. Not any more. The kingdom thrives, but there is no life in the dark woods."
Chapter 45. Cliff Cottage, 1913. Eliza knew she would miss this coastline, this sea, when she left. Though she would come to know another, it would be different. Other birds and other plants, waves whispering their stories in foreign tongues. Yet it was time. She'd waited long enough, and with little cause. What was done, and no matter her present feeling, the remorse that crept upon her in the dark held sleep at bay while she tossed and turned and cursed her part in the deception, she had little choice but to move forward. Eliza went the final way down the narrow stone steps to the pier. One fisherman was still loading up for the day's work, stacking woven baskets and rolls of line into his boat. As she drew closer, the lean, muscular limbs and sun-brushed features came into focus, and Eliza realized it was William, Mary's brother. Youngest in a long line of Cornish fishermen, he distinguished himself amongst a host of the brave and the foolhardy, so that tales of his feats spread like seagrass along the coast. He and Eliza had once enjoyed a friendship, and he had kept her in thrall with his wild stories of life on the sea, but a cool distance had grown between them for some years now. Ever since Will had witnessed that which he should not, had challenged Eliza and insisted she explain the inexplicable. It had been a long time since they'd spoken, and Eliza had missed his company. Knowledge that she would soon be leaving Tregenna filled her with determination to put the past behind her, and with a steady exhalation she made her approach. "You're late this morning, Will?" He looked up, straightened his cap. A blush spread across his weather-hardened cheeks, and he answered stiffly, "And you're early?" "I'm getting a head start on the day." Eliza was by the boat now. Water lapped gently against its side, and the air was thick with brine. "Any word from Mary?"
"Not since last week. She's still happy there in Polperro. Quite the butcher's wife she is, too."
Eliza smiled. It was a genuine pleasure to hear that Mary was well. After all she had been through, she deserved nothing less. "That is good news, Will. I must write her a letter this afternoon." William frowned a little. His gaze fell to his boots as he stubbed the rock wall of the pier.
"What is it?" said Eliza. "Have I said something odd?"
William shooed away a pair of greedy gulls, swooping for his bait.
"Will?"
He glanced sideways at Eliza.
"Nothing odd, Miss Eliza. Only, I must say, while I'm glad to see you well, I'm a little surprised."
"Why is that?"
"We were all sorry to hear the news."
He lifted his chin and scratched the whiskers that lined his sharp jaw.
"About Mr. and Mrs. Walker. About them leaving us."
"New York, yes. They leave next month."
Nathaniel had been the one to tell Eliza. He'd come to see her in the cottage again, ivory in tow once more. It was a rainy afternoon, and thus the child had been brought inside to wait. She'd gone upstairs to Eliza's room, which is just as well. When Nathaniel told Eliza of their plans, his and Rose's, to start afresh on the other side of the Atlantic, she had been angry. She'd felt abandoned, used, even more so than she had before. At the thought of Rose and Nathaniel in New York, the cottage had suddenly seemed like the most desolate place in the world. Eliza's life, the most desolate a person could lead. Soon after Nathaniel had left, Eliza had remembered Mother's advice, that she was to rescue herself, and she had decided the time had come to set her own plans in train. She'd booked passage on a ship that would take her on her own adventure, far from Blackhurst and the life she'd led in the cottage. She'd written, too, to Mrs. Swindle, said that she was coming to London in the next month, and wondered whether she might pay a visit. She hadn't mentioned Mother's brooch. God willing it was still stowed safely in the clay pot inside the disused chimney, but she intended to get it back. And with Mother's legacy, she would begin a new life, all her own. William cleared his throat.
"What is it, Will? You look as if you've seen a ghost."
"Nothing like that, Miss Eliza. It's just..."
His blue eyes scanned her own. The sun was full and heavy on the horizon now, and he was forced to squint.
Is it possible you don't know? Don't know what? She shrugged lightly. Of Mr. and Mrs. Walker. The train from Carlisle.
Eliza nodded. They've been in Carlisle these past days, due back tomorrow.
William's lips settled in a somber line. They're still due back tomorrow, Miss Eliza. Only not in the way you think. He sighed and shook his head. Words all over the village, in the newspapers. To think nobody told you. I'd have come myself, only...
He took her hands, an unexpected gesture, and one which set her heart to racing, as all unexpected shows of closeness were wont to do.
There was an accident, Miss Eliza. One train hit into another.
Some of the passengers, Mr. and Mrs. Walker, he exhaled, met her gaze.
I'm afraid they were both killed, Miss Eliza. Up at a place called Aysgill.
He continued, but Eliza wasn't listening. Inside her head, a loud red light had spread out over everything, so that all sensation, all noise, all thoughts were blocked. She closed her eyes and was falling, blindfolded, down a deep shaft without end. It was all Adeline could do to keep breathing. Grief so thick it blackened her lungs. The news had come by telephone late Tuesday night. Linus had been locked in the dark room, so Daisy had been sent to summon Lady Mountrachet to the receiver. A policeman on the other end, voice crackly with the miles of air that separated Cornwall from Cumberland, had delivered the crushing blow. Adeline had fainted. At least she presumed that must be what had happened, for her next memory was of waking in her bed, a heavy weight upon her chest. A split second of confusion, and then she'd remembered. The horror had been born afresh. It was as well there was a funeral to arrange, procedures to be followed, or else Adeline might not have resurfaced. For never mind that her heart had been hollowed out, leaving but a dry and worthless husk, there were certain things expected of her. As the grieving mother, she could not be seen to shirk her responsibilities. She owed it to Rose, to her dearest one.
Daisy, her voice was raw, fetch some writing paper. I need to prepare a list.
As Daisy hurried from the dim room, Adeline began her list mentally. The Churchills should be invited, of course, Lord and Lady Huxley, the Astors, the Hoysers, Nathaniel's people she would inform later. Lord knew Adeline hadn't the strength to incorporate their type at Rose's funeral. Neither would the child be permitted to attend. Such a solemn occasion was no place for one of her nature. Would that she had been on the train with her parents, that the beginnings of a cold had not kept her home in bed. For what was Adeline to do with the girl? The last thing she needed was a constant reminder that Rose was gone. She stared out of the window towards the cove, the line of trees, the sea beyond, stretching forever and forever and forever. Adeline refused to let her eyes shift left. The cottage was hidden from view, but knowing it was there was enough. Its horrid pull exerted itself, brought a chill to her blood. One thing was certain. Eliza would not be told, not until after the funeral. There was no way Adeline could bear to see that girl alive and well when Rose was not. 3 days later, while Adeline and Linus and the servants gathered at the cemetery on the far side of the estate, Eliza took a last walk around the cottage. She had already sent a case ahead to the port, so there was little for her to carry. Just a small travelling bag with her notebook and some personal items. The train left Tregenna at midday,
and Davies, who was collecting a shipment of new plants from the London train, had offered to drive her to the station. He was the only one she'd told that she was going. Eliza checked her small pocket watch. There was time for one last visit to the hidden garden. She had saved the garden until last, purposely limited the time she would have available to spend there, for fear if she granted longer, she would be unable ever to extricate herself. But so would it be. So must it be. Eliza went around the path and made her way towards the entrance. Where once the southern door had stood, now was only an open wound, a hole in the ground, and a stack of huge sandstone blocks awaiting use. It had happened during the week. Eliza had been weeding when she'd been surprised by a pair of burly workmen making their way through from the front of the cottage. Her first thought was that they were lost. Then she realized the absurdity of such a notion. People didn't stumble upon the cottage accidentally. "Lady Mountrachet sent us," the taller of the men said. Eliza stood, wiping her hands on her skirt. She said nothing as she waited for him to continue. "She says this door wants removing."
"Does it now?" said Eliza. "Funny, it's never said as much to me."
The smaller man sniggered. The tall man looked sheepish. "And why is the door being removed?" said Eliza. "Is there another replacing it?"
"We're to brick up the hole," said the taller man. "Lady Mountrachet says there won't be access needed from the cottage no more. We're to dig a hole and lay new foundations."
Of course. Eliza should have expected there would be repercussions after her journey through the maze a fortnight before. When all was done and decided 4 years ago, the rules had been clearly set out. Mary had been given funds to start afresh in Polperro, and Eliza had been forbidden from crossing beyond the hidden garden and into the maze. Yet finally, she had been unable to resist. It was just as well Eliza would be at the cottage no longer. Without access to her garden, she didn't think she could bear life at Blackhurst. Certainly not now that Rose was gone. She stepped her way over the rubble where the door had once stood, around the edge of the hole, and crossed into the hidden garden. The scent of jasmine was still strong, and the apple tree was fruiting. The creepers had made their way right across the top of the garden and plaited themselves together to form a leafy canopy. Davies would look in, she knew that, but it wouldn't be the same. He had sufficient duties to keep him busy, and the garden took so much of her time and love.
"What will become of you?" said Eliza softly.
She looked at the apple tree, and a sharp pain lodged within her chest, as if some part of her heart had been removed. She remembered the day she had planted the tree with Rose. So much hope they'd had then, so much faith that all would turn out well. Eliza couldn't bear even to contemplate that Rose was no longer in the world. Something caught Eliza's eye then. A piece of fabric protruding from beneath the foliage of the apple tree. Had she left a handkerchief here last time she came? She knelt down and peered through the leaves. There was a little girl, Rose's little girl, fast asleep on the soft grass. As if by the lifting of some enchantment, the child stirred, blinked open her eyes until her wide gaze fixed on Eliza. She didn't jump or startle or behave in any way that might have been expected from a child caught unawares by an adult not well known to them. She smiled, comfortably, then yawned, then crawled out from underneath the branch.
"Hello," she said, standing before Eliza.
Eliza stared at her, surprised and pleased by the girl's utter disregard for the stifling dictates of manners.
"What are you doing here?"
"Reading."
Eliza's brows lifted. The girl was not yet 4.
"You can read?"
Brief hesitation, then a nod.
"Show me."
The little girl dropped to her hands and knees and scurried beneath the apple tree branch. withdrew her own copy of Eliza's fairy tales, the copy Eliza had taken through the maze. She opened the book and launched into a perfect rendition of The Crone's Eyes, tracing her finger earnestly along the text. Eliza concealed a smile as she noticed the fingertip and the voice were not in step, remembered her own childhood ability to memorize favorite stories. "And why are you here?" she said. The girl paused in her reading.
"Everybody else has gone away. I saw them from the window, shiny black carriages crawling down the driveway like a line of busy ants. And I didn't want to be alone in the house, so I came here. I like it here, best of all, in your garden."
Her gaze flickered towards the ground. She knew that she had crossed a line.
"Do you know who I am?" Eliza said. "You're the authoress."
Eliza smiled slightly. The little girl grew bolder, tilted her head to one side so that her long plait spilled over her shoulder.
"Why are you sad?"
"Because I'm saying goodbye."
"To what?"
"To my garden. To my old life." There was an intensity to the little girl's gaze that Eliza found bewitching. "I am going on an adventure. Do you like adventures?" The little girl nodded.
"I am going on an adventure soon, too, with Mama and Papa. We're going to New York on a giant ship, bigger even than Captain Ahab's."
"New York?" Eliza faltered. Was it possible the little girl didn't know that her parents were dead?
"We're going across the sea, and Grandmama and Grandpapa won't be coming with us. Nor the horrid broken dolly."
Was that the point from which there was no return? As Eliza met the earnest eyes of a little girl who didn't know that her parents were dead, who faced a life with Aunt Adeline and Uncle Linus as guardians? Later, when Eliza looked back, it would seem that no decision had been made. Rather, that the decision had already been made for her. By some strange process of alchemy, Eliza had known instantly and certainly that the girl could not be left alone at Blackhurst. She held out her hand, observed her own palm extended towards the girl, as if it knew precisely what it did. She pressed her lips together and found her voice. "I have heard about your adventure. In fact, I have been sent to collect you." The words came easily now, as if they were part of a plan made long ago, as if they were truth. "I am going to take you some of the way." The little girl blinked.
"It's all right," Eliza said.
"Come. Take my hand. We're going to go a special way, a secret way that no one knows but us."
"Will my mama be there when we get to the place we're going?"
"Yes," said Eliza without flinching. "Your mama will be there." The little girl considered this, nodded her head approvingly, sharp little chin with a dimple in its center.
"I must bring my book."
Adeline felt the edges of her mind unfurl. It had been mid-afternoon before the alarm was raised. Daisy, stupid girl, had come knocking at Adeline's boudoir door, hedging her words, shifting sheepishly from one foot to the other, wondering whether perhaps the mistress had seen Miss Ivory. Her granddaughter was a known wanderer, so Adeline's first instinct had been irritation. Just like the wicked girl to choose her timing thus. Today, of all days, having buried her darling Rose, consigned her child to the earth, now to have to mount a search. It was all Adeline could do not to shriek and curse. The servants had been enlisted, sent throughout the house to check the usual nooks, but all to no avail. When an hour had been fruitlessly exhausted, Adeline had been forced to contemplate the possibility that Ivory had gone further afield. Adeline, and Rose too, had warned the child against the cove and other areas of the estate. But obedience had not come easily for Ivory, as it had for Rose. There was a willfulness about her, a deplorable trait that Rose had indulged by eschewing punishment. But Adeline was not so lenient, and when the girl was found, she would be made to see the error of her ways. She would not offend so brazenly again.
"Excuse me, ma'am."
Adeline swung around, the folds of her skirt hissing against each other. It was Daisy, returned finally from the cove.
"Well, where is she?" said Adeline.
"I couldn't see her, ma'am."
"You checked all over? The Black Rock? The hills?"
"Oh, no, ma'am. I didn't go near the Black Rock."
"Why ever not?"
"It's so big and slippery, and..."
The girl's silly face turned bright as a ripe peach.
"They say it's haunted, is the Great Rock."
Adeline's face itched to slap the girl black and blue. If she had just done as instructed in the first place and ensured the child remained in bed. No doubt she'd been off somewhere talking to the new footman in the kitchen. But it would not do to punish Daisy, not yet. It might seem as if Adeline's priorities were out of step. Instead, she turned away, swept her skirts behind her, and repaired to the window. Looked out across the darkening lawn. It was all so overwhelming. Ordinarily, Adeline found herself adept at the art of social performance. But today, the part of the concerned grandmother was proving her undoing. If only someone would find the girl, dead or alive, injured or well, and bring her back. Then Adeline could close the door on the episode and continue unabated in her grieving for Rose. But it seemed that such a simple solution was not to be. Dusk would be upon them in the matter of an hour, and still no sign of the child. And Adeline's pursuit could not be ended until every option was exhausted. The servants were watching. Her reactions were no doubt being reported and dissected in the servants' hall. So must she continue the hunt. Daisy was near useless, and the other staff not much better. She needed Davies. Where was that brute of a man when he was needed?
"It's his afternoon off, ma'am," said Daisy when asked.
Of course it was. The servants were always underfoot, yet never to be found.
"I imagine he's at home, or visiting in the village, m'lady. I think he said something about fetching some deliveries off the train."
There was only one other person who knew the estate like Davies.
"Fetch Miss Eliza, then," said Adeline, mouth souring as she spoke the name, "and bring her to me at once."
Eliza looked across at the sleeping child. Long lashes dusted smooth cheeks. Pink lips sat plump and pouted, little fists bunched on her lap. How trusting children were to find sleep at such a time. The trust, the vulnerability, made a part of Eliza want to weep. What had she been thinking? What was she doing here on a train, heading towards London with Rose's child? Nothing. She had thought nothing at all, and that's why she had done it. For to think was to dip the paint-loaded brush of doubt into the clear water of certainty. She had known the child could not be left alone at Blackhurst in the hands of Uncle Linus and Aunt Adeline. Thus had she acted. She had failed Sammy, but she wouldn't fail again. What to do with Ivory now was another question, for surely Eliza couldn't keep her. The child deserved more than that. She should have a father and mother, siblings, a happy home filled with love that would grant her memories for a lifetime. And yet Eliza couldn't see what choice she had. The child must be kept far from Cornwall. The risk otherwise was too great that she'd be discovered and taken straight back to Blackhurst. No, until Eliza thought of some better alternative, the girl must stay with her. At least for now.
There were 5 days until the ship departed for Australia, for Maryborough, where Mary's brother lived, and her Aunt Eleanor. Mary had given her an address, and when she got there, Eliza intended to contact the Martin family. She would send word to Mary, of course, let her know what she had done. Eliza already had her ticket, booked under a false name. Superstitious, but when time had come to make the reservation, she had been possessed, suddenly, by an overwhelming sensation that a clean break required a new name. She didn't want to leave an imprint of herself at the booking office, a path between this world and that. So she had used a pseudonym, a stroke of luck, as it turned out. For they would come looking. Eliza knew too much about the origins of Rosa's child for Aunt Adeline to let her slip so easily away. She must be prepared to hide. She would find an inn near the port, somewhere that would rent a room to a poor widow and her child, on their way to join family in the new world. Was it possible, she wondered, to purchase a ticket for the child at such short notice? Or would she find a way to board the girl without drawing attention to her? Eliza looked across at the scrap of a child, slumbering in the corner of the train carriage. So vulnerable. She reached out slowly and stroked her cheek. Withdrew as the girl flinched, wrinkled her little nose and nestled her head further into the carriage corner. Ridiculous though it was, Eliza could see some of Rose in the child, in ivory. Rose as a girl, when Eliza had first known her. The child would ask after her mother and father, and Eliza would tell her one day. Though which words she would find to explain, she wasn't sure. She noticed that the fairy story that might have done so for her was no longer in the little girl's collection. Someone had removed it. Nathaniel, Eliza suspected. Both Rose and Aunt Adeline would have destroyed the whole book. Only Nathaniel would pluck out the one story in which he was implicated, yet preserve the rest. She would wait to contact the Swindles until the very last. For though Eliza couldn't see how they might pose a threat, she knew better than to be too trusting. If an opportunity to profit was glimpsed, the Swindles would seize upon it. Eliza had considered at one point abandoning the visit, wondered whether perhaps the risk outweighed the reward, but she had decided to take the chance. She would need the gems from the brooch in order to pay her way in the new world, and the plattered part was precious. It was her family, her past, her link to herself. As Adeline waited for Daisy's return, time dragged slow and heavy, like a petulant child at her skirt. It was Eliza's fault that Rose was dead. Her unsanctioned visit through the maze had precipitated the plans for New York, and thus brought forward the trip to Carlisle. Had Eliza stayed on the other side of the estate as she had promised, Rose would never have been on that train. The door opened, and Adeline drew breath. Finally, the servant was back, leaves in her hair, mud on her skirt, and yet she was alone. "Where is she?" Adeline said. Was she searching already? Had Daisy used her own head for once and sent Eliza straight to the cove? "I don't know, ma'am." "You don't know? When I got to the cottage, it were all locked up. I looked through the windows, but there was no sign." "You should have waited a while. Perhaps she was in the village and would have returned soon." The girl was shaking her insolent head. "I don't think so, ma'am. Only the fire were raked clean, and the shelves were empty." Daisy blinked in that bovine way of hers. "I think she's gone too, ma'am." Then Adeline understood. And knowledge heated quickly into rage, and rage seared beneath her skin, filling her head with sharp red shots of pain. "Are you all right, my lady? Should you sit down?" No, Adeline didn't need to sit down. Quite the contrary. She needed to see for herself, witness the girl's ingratitude. "Take me through the maze, Daisy."
"I don't know my way through, ma'am. No one does. None excepting Davies. I went round the roadway,
up the cliff track. Then fetch Newton and the carriage.
But it'll be getting dark soon, Mum.
Adeline narrowed her eyes and lifted her shoulders, enunciated clearly.
Fetch Newton now and bring me a lantern.
The cottage was neat, but not empty. The kitchen area was still hung with various cooking instruments, but the table was wiped clear. The coat hook by the door was bare. Adeline suffered a wave of illness and felt her lungs contract. It was that girl's lingering presence, thick and oppressive. She took the lantern and started up the narrow stairs. There were two rooms, the larger spartan but clean, containing the bed from the attic, an old quilt pulled tight across its surface. The other housed a desk and chair and a shelf full of books. The objects on the desk had been arranged into stacks. Adeline pressed her fingers against the wooden top and leaned forward a little to see outside. The last color of the day had broken over the sea, and the distant water rose and fell, gold and purple. Rose is gone. The thought came fast and jagged. Here, alone, finally unobserved, Adeline could briefly stop pretending. She closed her eyes, and the knots in her shoulders dropped. She longed to curl up on the floor, wooden boards smooth and cool and real beneath her cheek, and never have to rise again. To sleep for 100 years. To have no one looking to her for an example. To be able to breathe.
Lady Mountrachet?
Newton's voice drifted up the stairs.
'Tis growing dark, my lady. The horses will have difficulty getting down if we don't leave soon.
Adeline drew a sharp breath. Shoulders were wrenched back into position.
A minute.
She opened her eyes and pressed a hand against her forehead. Rose was gone, and Adeline would never recover. But there was further risk now. Though a part of Adeline longed to let Eliza and the girl disappear out of her life forever, things were more complicated than that. With Eliza and Ivory missing, surely together, Adeline faced the risk that people might learn the truth, that Eliza might speak of what they'd done. And that must not be allowed to happen. For Rose's sake, for her memory, and for the Mountrachet family's good name, Eliza must be found, returned, and silenced. Adeline's gaze swept once more across the desktop and lit upon the edge of a piece of paper emerging from beneath a stack of books. A word she recognized, though at first could not place. She plucked the paper from where it was lodged. It was a list of sorts, made by Eliza, things to be done before she left. At the bottom of the list was printed Swindle. A name, Adeline thought, though she wasn't sure how she knew. Her heart beat faster as she folded the piece of paper and tucked it in her pocket. Adeline had found her link. The girl couldn't expect to slip from notice. She would be found, and the child, Rose's child, brought back where she belonged. And Adeline knew just whose help to enlist to make it so.
Chapter 46. Polperro, 2005. Clara's cottage was small and white, and clung to the edge of a rock sheer, a short walk uphill from a pub called the Buccaneer.
"Want to do the honors?" asked Christian when they arrived.
Cassandra nodded, but she didn't knock. She had been beset, suddenly, by a wave of nervous excitement. Her grandmother's long-lost sister was on the other side of the door. In just a few moments, the riddle that had plagued Nell for most of her life would be solved. Cassandra glanced at Christian and thought again how pleased she was that he had come with her. After Ruby had left for London that morning, Cassandra had waited for him on the front steps of the hotel, clutching her copy of Eliza's fairy tales.
He'd brought his, too, and they'd discovered that there was indeed a story missing from Cassandra's book. The gap in the binding was so narrow, the cut so neat, that Cassandra hadn't noticed it before. Even the missing page numbers hadn't drawn her attention. The figures were so swirly, so elaborate, that it would have taken a degree in penmanship to discern the difference between 54 and 61. On the drive to Polperro, Cassandra had read The Golden Egg aloud. As she did so, she'd become more and more convinced that Christian was right, that the story was an allegory for Rose's acquisition of her daughter, a fact which made her more certain than ever of what it was that Clara wished to tell her. Poor Mary, forced to give up her first child, then keep it a secret. No wonder she'd unburdened herself to her daughter in her final days. A lost child followed a mother all her life. Leo would be almost 12 now. Are you okay? Christian was watching her, a frown of concern narrowing his eyes. Yeah, said Cassandra, folding away her memories. I'm okay. And as she smiled at him, it didn't feel so much a lie as usual. She lifted her hand and was about to rap on the knocker when the door flew open. Standing in the low and narrow frame was a plump old woman whose apron, tied around her middle, gave the impression of a body formed by two balls of dough. "I seen you standin' there," she said, grinning, finger curled to point at them, "and I says to myself, they must be my young guests. Now come on in, the two of you, and I'll make us all a nice cup of tea." Christian sat beside Cassandra on the floral sofa, and they juggled patchwork cushions between them to make room. He looked so hopelessly oversized amongst such dainty adornments that Cassandra had to fight the urge to laugh. A yellow teapot occupied pride of place on the sea chest in the lounge room, shrouded in a knitted cozy shaped like a hen. It looked remarkably like Clara, Cassandra thought. Small, alert eyes, a plump body, sharp little mouth. Clara fetched a third cup and strained leaf tea into each. "My own special blend," she said. "Three parts breakfast, one part Earl Grey." She peered over her half glasses. "English breakfast, that is." When the milk was added, she eased herself into the armchair by the fire. "About time I gave my poor old feet a rest. Been on them all day, organizing the stalls for the Harbor Festival." "Thanks for seeing me," said Cassandra. "This is my friend, Christian." Christian reached across the sea chest to shake Clara's hand, and she blushed. "Pleasure to meet you, I'm sure." She took a sip of tea, then nodded towards Cassandra. "The museum lady, Ruby, told me about your grandma," she said, "the one what didn't know who her parents were." "Nell," said Cassandra. "That was her name. My great-grandfather Hugh found her when she was a little girl, sitting on top of a white suitcase on the Maryborough Wharf. He was portmaster, and a ship..." "Maryborough, you see." Cassandra nodded. "No, that's a coincidence, that is. I've got family in a place called Maryborough. In the Queensland." "Queensland?" Cassandra leaned forward. "Which family?" "My mum's brother moved there when he was a young fellow. Raised his children. My cousins." She cackled. "Mum used to say they'd settled there for her name's sake." Cassandra glanced at Christian. Was that why Eliza had put Nell on that particular ship? Was she returning her to Mary's family? To Nell's own true family? Rather than take the child to Polperro and risk having local people recognize her as Ivory Mountechet, had she opted for Mary's faraway brother? Cassandra suspected that Clara held the answer. All she needed was nudging in the right direction.
Your mother, Mary, used to work at Blackhurst Manor, didn't she? Clara swallowed a large gulp of tea.
Worked there until she was given her marching orders. 1909, that was. She'd been there since she was but a girl. Near on 10 years. Let go for being in the family way.
Clara lowered her voice to a whisper.
Wasn't married, you see. And in those days, that wasn't the done thing. But she wasn't a bad girl, my mum. She was straight as a pound of candles. She and my dad were married in the end, right and proper. Would have done so before, only he was struck down with the pneumonia. Nearly didn't make it to his own wedding. That's when they moved here to Polperro. They came into a little bit of money and started the butchery.
She picked up a small rectangular book from beside the tea tray. The cover was decorated with wrapping paper and fabric and buttons, and when Clara opened it, Cassandra realized it was a photo album. Clara turned to a page that had been marked with a ribbon and handed it across the sea chest.
That there is my mum.
Cassandra looked at the young woman with wild curls and wilder curves, trying to see Nell in her features. There was perhaps something of Nell about the mouth, a smile that played on her lips when she least intended. Then again, that was the nature of photos. The longer Cassandra looked, the more she seemed to see something of Aunt Philly about the nose and eyes. She handed the album to Christian and smiled at Clara. She was very pretty, wasn't she?
Oh, yes, said Clara with a saucy wink. Quite the looker was my mum. Too pretty for service.
Did she enjoy her time at Blackhurst, do you know? Was she sorry to leave?
She was glad to leave the house, but sad to leave her mistress.
This was new. She and Rose were close.
Clara shook her head. I don't know about no Rose. It was Eliza she used to talk about. Miss Eliza this, Miss Eliza that.
But Eliza wasn't the mistress of Blackhurst Manor.
Well, not officially, no. But she was always the apple of my mum's eye. She used to say Miss Eliza was the only spark of life in a dead place.
Why did she think it a dead place?
Those that lived there were like the dead, my mum said. All gloomy for one reason or another. All wanting things they shouldn't or couldn't have.
Cassandra pondered on this insight into life at Blackhurst Manor. It wasn't the impression she'd formed from reading Rose's scrapbooks, though certainly Rose, with her focus on new dresses and the adventures of her cousin Eliza, provided only one voice in a house that must have echoed with others. That was the nature of history, of course, notional, partial, unknowable, a record made by the victors.
Her bosses, the lord and lady, were each as nasty as the other, according to my mum. They got theirs in the end, though, didn't they?
Cassandra frowned. Who did?
Him and her. Lord and Lady Mountrachet. She died a month or two after her daughter. Poisoning of the blood, it was.
Clara shook her head and lowered her voice conspiratorially, almost gleefully.
Very nasty. My mum heard tell.